Good evening. It is January. I think it is January the 8th. I'm going to double check here. January the 8th, 2019. It's Tuesday. It is the early evening in Seattle, Washington. Last couple days, it's been a little bit rainy and dreary here, but that's not abnormal for Seattle. I didn't necessarily have a good topic for today's little Saigon report, in part because I had a very uncomfortable conversation with someone today about, you know, life and the future and what my plans were. If you follow my podcasts, and, you know, I feel sorry for you if you do, right? But if you listen to my podcasts and you've understood the undertone of a general angst and just not so optimistic view of the future in much of it, you probably wouldn't be amazed by the nature of that conversation. But one of the things that I find interesting, and it's kind of this, I don't know how to describe it. It seems pathological to me, but I don't want to call it a pathology. I don't want to call it a disease. It is dysfunctional. But one of the features of the disappearing middle class, and you could call it the deer in the headlights or whatever you want to, is this general blindness to the reality that much or most of the world, in terms of raw population, and much or most of this country in terms of numbers, they're not making any progress. In fact, you could make the opposing argument quite soundly that not only are most Americans and most of the human population not really making progress, but in fact, we're kind of going backwards. Now, there are a lot of people in what I would call the progress religion, the religion of human progress, who would say, but wait a minute, Dan, you know, the numbers on human poverty and blah, 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 and fewer people are dying of this. Well, I got two things to say about numbers, and they generally agree with what Mark Twain said once. You know, Mark Twain once said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And when I was younger, I didn't fully understand that quote. As I've gotten older, I've realized that much of the world of numbers has a lot to do with the evidence itself, the actual data, and derivatively, but critically, also the models applied. So there are two parts of kind of the way you represent the world with numbers. One is the data. How did you collect it? Where did you get the data from? And the other is, how do you interpret the data? And either in terms of source or interpretation, I find most of what is considered reputable sources of data these days to not be that at all, to be the opposite. It kind of fits my general notion that many things these days, especially if they're professed by those in a position of power, should be seen in terms of opposites. So if somebody calls something the Patriot Act, you should call it the Unpatriot Act, because that's actually what it is. If somebody talks about a war on drugs, you should really understand that it is a war for the expansion of the black market of selling drugs. You should understand a war on terror is actually a plan, an agenda, an initiative to spread terror, to spread death. So a lot of these numbers are best seen in terms of opposites. And another rule I generally follow, and I think it's a solid rule with respect to various forms of authority, whether it's, you know, a corporate authority in the quote-unquote business world, which really no longer exists, you know, so if it's some big crony corporation or it's the government, and really in America at this point, the difference between a big crony corporation and the government, there is no difference. It's the same ruling class. But when it comes to the ruling class, if they have a statistic or a number that they want high, the real number you probably need to divide by 10. And if they have a number they want to be displayed as low, the real number is probably multiplied by 10. I'm not saying that's a perfect heuristic, but I think it's far closer to the truth. So for example, let's say the population of the United States is roughly 350 million people, plus or minus. Truly, I don't know. I don't know what the real number is. I, you know, I think probably 10 years ago, that might have been the quoted number. So it could be 400 million people. Who knows? But let's call it 400 million. Currently, the best data from the ruling class tells us that there are only 250,000 people in the whole United States that are homeless. Now, I got to tell you, living here in King County, at least the part of King County I live in, you know, the Seattle area, I find that number to be dubious. Because just in the Seattle area alone, it seems like we probably have 20 or 30,000 homeless people. Of course, the number that King County quotes is 11,000 homeless people. I don't know that that number could possibly be true. But again, like I said, if the government wants a number low, whether it's homelessness, whether it's crime, you name the number. If the government or some ruling authority wants the number low, the real number, you probably need to add a multiplier. So take 10, multiply the number by 10 if the government or authority wants it low, and that might get you to the right number. And the same thing applies on the other side. If the government wants a number high, okay, like GDP, you probably should divide if you want to know the real number, or at least subtract. And I went off on this tangent because I think the middle class in America, what's left of it, and I was listening to kind of a financial theorist the other day. I think it was Lior Gantz, but he was one of these people saying that, you know, in a couple of years, we might as well say there is no longer a middle class in America. That essentially within a couple of years, you're going to have two classes. And I think we're already there. You have an ultra wealthy class, or at least a fairly wealthy class. Let's call this the group of people who make enough money that they don't have to be in debt. That doesn't mean that they're not in debt, okay? That doesn't mean that they're not leveraged, but they make enough money that in theory, they don't have to be in debt. So if they're in debt, they're in debt because of some business venture. And in all likelihood, they're not in personal debt, because when you get to that level, you usually create an LLC or some organization to capture your debts, kind of like how Trump did things. You know, Trump went bankrupt many times, but he didn't lose all his fortunes. Why? Because all of his bankruptcies happened with businesses. And I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I got mixed feelings about the way business operates in America. But when you get to that level, even bankruptcy doesn't mean the same thing. Okay? So you got a class of people in this country who are more or less insulated by, or I should say insulated from, economic chaos, you know, from the Sturm und Drang of the world that the little guy, the peon, people like us live in. And then you got the rest of us. And I don't want to fool around with percentages, but what I would say is this. Let's say there's 400 million people, 400 million Americans. The current number the government quotes is around 250,000 homeless. Well, I would say that number is 10 times too small. That it is way more likely that the number of homeless in this country is closer to 3 million than 250,000. It doesn't seem likely at all that it's lower, and it seems extraordinarily likely that it's higher than that. So my guess would be currently that, and again, this isn't evenly distributed, you know, kind of like the biological functions of the stranded skier, the stranded unconscious skier, slowly dying of hypothermia but not knowing it. Certain parts of the body are going to start dying immediately, like the extremities, the arms and the legs. Other parts, because of the way the body works, will last longer. Now, if you happen to be in one of those warmer, snugger parts of the body, or in the brain having some fantasy of that last ski trip while you're slowly dying, you might think things are just fine. In fact, the brain will be giving you that fantasy, you know, maybe it's some trip you went on, whatever, and your core keeps, you know, bumping along. And that's kind of how it works in the world in terms of America, and also recursively worldwide. There are parts of the world and parts of America that seem to have a kind of economic prosperity, okay? I think it's mostly bullshit. It's kind of like the Amazon economy. Amazon doesn't make any fucking money, really. But they grow like cancer. And as long as they keep growing, and as long as there's enough money sloshing about from certain people, who still have money or can go into debt, then Amazon continues to have revenue. Okay? But this is kind of a fake prosperity, because as I said, per the stranded skier analogy, other parts of the body are dying, and once you lose your arms and your legs, it's going to be real tough to save yourself. Maybe you'll get saved by someone else. So my rough guess, if I were going to take a rough guess, is about 1 in 300 people in America are currently homeless. That's a rough guess, 1 in 300. Now, that may not seem like a huge percentage. It's not even a full percentage point. It's like 0.33%, roughly, of America is currently homeless. I think it could be worse than that. And after 10 years of the second longest sarcastic quote-unquote recovery, economic recovery, you would think it would be better than that. You know, supposedly we have 3.5% unemployment. Again, following my rule as far as government numbers go, you should multiply that times 3. By 10. You know, I think it's way more likely that we're closer to 25% real unemployment than we are 3.5%. I would be willing to split the difference and say we're still probably around 15% unemployment in this country, but it gets masked over by a lot of number garbage, you know, by people having two or three jobs, by people doing two or three different kinds of jobs at two or three different parts of the year. So one person in this quote-unquote gig economy could look like they have like six or seven jobs, and an economist looks at that and says, wow, that's prosperity. You know, it would take an economist to see it that way. But it's not. It's not prosperity. So, yeah, when it comes to these numbers, and homelessness is a good example, you really need to be skeptical. But the problem is, where do you go for the real source? If you're dependent upon information that comes from the World Wide Web, if you're dependent upon data that comes from the Federal Reserve, or even stuff that's kind of aggregated through a journal like The Economist or The Wall Street Journal or something like that, or Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. If you're dependent upon these sources, how do you vet them? How do you know they're telling you the truth? And the reason why I'm talking about this in terms of the middle class is because it does come back to this issue. This, I don't want to call it a disease. It's not a disease. It's not a pathology. But it is a feature of consciousness that exists. I don't have it. But a lot of people in the middle class are so confused by what's happening to them, especially families, especially people raising kids, that they grasp at straws and they try to come up with rationalizations for how it's all going to be okay. There are no issues. You have nothing to worry about. So here I am. And again, I'm not special. I need to underline this point. I'm almost 50 years old. I'm white. I'm male. I'm not special. Yeah, I'm divorced. I am currently between jobs, and I'm almost out of money. I have a few college degrees, which really means nothing at this point, and I have a lot of debt. If you put that all into a big picture, from my perspective, it doesn't really speak to a great future, especially, like I said, I'm almost 50, so yeah. Do I ever expect to retire? No. Did I ever really believe that was a reality? Not really. But it is a belief system on the part of a lot of people in the middle class. It's like Social Security. It is a belief amongst many that they will have this magical thing called Social Security when they retire. And they might. They might. I don't think it's very likely at this point. I don't see how private pension funds or Social Security or Medicare or any of these systems remain solvent in the coming decades unless a couple of things happen. Unless either A, you have a massive die-off because current productivity doesn't support it, so you'd have to have a lot of people just die. And then, yeah, maybe. But then in that situation, I don't see a lot of economic growth, at least not initially. Probably more chaos than anything else. So there's the scenario with some massive die-off, or there's the magical scenario. And this is the one that I think most people in the middle class who still exist in the middle class get suckered into. And you can call this a religion of progress if you want to. You can call this the technological delusion. James Howard Kunstler wrote a book I read a few years ago called Too Much Magic. And it was sort of a follow-on to The Long Emergency, which deals with issues of peak oil, but more importantly, the utilization of resources in a finite world, you know, on a finite planet. But yeah, there's this general delusion that technology will save us. So barring a world war, which is more or less what you would need at this point to reset GDP growth, you'd have to have massive destruction. And before you say I'm crazy, you know, Dan, you're crazy, you need to take a look at the GDP growth in 2017 and 2018. And if you factor out things like hurricanes and other natural disasters, if you factor out the quote-unquote disaster capitalism, you're not left with any GDP growth. You're left with flatline or worse. So a lot of the GDP growth we've experienced is a numbers game. It's, you know, it's what, you know, Bastiat would refer to as the broken window fallacy, that somehow if a storekeeper has their window broken, well, that's great for the economy because now, you know, the storekeeper has to spend money to buy windows from the glassmaker. And that kind of makes sense in a corrupt world. But in reality, that was a loss. So yeah, the what's left of the middle class, and I don't think there's much left of the middle class, but what's left of the middle class is grasping at straws. A number of years ago, I saw an article, I think it probably came out in the press, and this happens, so you know, every 4 or 5 years or 10 years, you'll get these articles on certain topics, but this particular article was on the perennial topic of fusion energy. And this was 2014. And one of the things it was saying was, well, Lockheed expects to have a fusion reactor that will fit in the back of your pickup within 10 years. That would mean 2024. So sometime in the year 2024, 2025, Lockheed expects to have a fusion reactor that will fit in the back of your truck. Now, this is the kind of techno garbage that gets produced in science journalism all the time. But what a lot of Americans don't realize, and they ought to think about, is that fusion energy as a concept, as a way to save us, has been promised to be 10 years away every year since World War II. Okay? This is not a new thing. Fusion energy has been a quote-unquote promised land for more than 50 years and, you know, 60, 70 years now. It's crazy. And yet, it's not very likely. It isn't going to happen. If it did happen, then yeah, you would have that other way in which people can retire and live a life that's not horrible. But barring some massive shift in technology that allows GDP growth to grow again, barring something unprecedented, and it would really have to be bigger than the miniaturization revolution in electronics that brought on the computer revolution, that was big, but that was more about getting more computation and using less energy, okay? That wasn't about producing new energy. That was about using the same amount of energy and getting more computation, something that, you know, a computer scientist might get, but a lot of people might not actually get, okay? And by the way, barring quantum computers, which I'm still very skeptical in terms of their practicality, we are currently peaking out with Moore's Law, just a separate side topic. You know, we have gotten to the point where we stack so many transistors together, it is not likely that we're going to do much better in the next 20 years in terms of computational power, barring quantum computation. So this is the thing. You have this persistent delusion, and it's not that difficult to understand. I get it, especially when it comes to people raising families. There's so much uncertainty, so much anxiety, so many concerns, that if you read an article that says, well, shit, in 10 years, robots will be doing everything, or in 20 years, we'll be post-scarcity, talk about all of the boondoggle concepts. Post-scarcity is one of the most ridiculous. One of the arguments that people make right now for persistent deflation and the depression we're in is, well, we're almost at post-scarcity. So we need universal basic income, and maybe people only need to work 20 hours a week. That seems like bullshit to me. In part because I know people that work two or three jobs and just barely get by. So that seems like total bullshit to me, the post-scarcity economy. But a lot of this is, you know, it's music to people's ears. Because again, if you stop believing the lie of progress, the lie that, you know, you were taught in school, that things will simply get better and better. If you turn away from your phone for a second or put down your smartphone and just walk outside your neighborhood and ask yourself, is this neighborhood in better shape today than it was 10 years ago or worse shape? These questions don't have nice answers. If you go to your nearest bridge and you look at the rusty bolts or the corrosion near important features of the bridge that maintain structural integrity, can you ask yourself or can you ponder the question, are the structures, the actual infrastructure that supports modern commerce, is it better than it was 10 or 20 years ago, or worse? I will say that when it comes to weapons technology, it does seem like the government, the United States, you know, seems to have a lot of progress. But even there, I don't even know if that's true. It too could be smoke and mirrors. It's one thing to use high technology to beat up on people that essentially are living out of caves. That's no great feat. In fact, if you lose to them, you have to ask yourself what you're doing wrong. But it's no great feat to use high technology to kill people that don't have even remotely the same level of technology. That's essentially a bully with, you know, a Louisville slugger picking a fight with someone that can barely walk. You know, it's not a fair fight. It was never going to be a fair fight. But yet, even there, we don't do so well. I mean, I'm hard-pressed to say, have we been victorious in the war on terror? I mean, knowing that it really is a war for terror, have we been victorious? Well, if the purpose of the war on terror is to spread chaos, which I think it is, then it's been a great success. But if the purpose was to win, well, it looks like more of the world is falling apart today than it was before 9/11. So it looks like we're losing, actually. And I know this seems like one of my rants that goes all over the place, but it's uncomfortable because I was talking to somebody today about being homeless. And just full disclosure, probably within a few weeks, it could happen to me. I could be homeless. I've thought about it for more than a year now that it could happen. I never really wanted to believe it. I always thought I'd figure out a way to keep going, you know, as most of us do. But I reached a brick wall a few months ago, a combination of events, some of which happened in a professional setting while working as a software engineer, and just other shit that just kind of blew up, and I haven't been able to find work again. And I'm at the point now where unless I really, really, really hustle, you know, I mean, really hustle, and I don't even know what that looks like, to be blunt, but unless I figure out a way through this, it's just not that likely that I'm going to find any job, let alone a good job, in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Like, that's when I run out of rent. That's when I become homeless. So I was talking to somebody about homelessness, and the general feeling on the part of the person I was talking to was, well, this is crazy. How could you end up homeless? And my thought was, how conceited is it? And not this particular person in question, but how conceited is it that any American would say, well, it's impossible for me to end up homeless? Listen, people with wealth and resources have become paupers overnight throughout history. It's not impossible. For ordinary people like me, for people that basically start out adult life with student loan debt and for whatever reason never get that much further down the road, homelessness is only a couple months away, you know? Homeless is, I think for a lot of Americans right now, being homeless best case scenario is 2 to 3 months away. If they lose their job, if they don't have any income coming in, maybe they own their house, which is good. If they don't own a house and they rent, or they're paying a mortgage, homelessness might only be a few months away. And if you have kids, I think it becomes a question of, do you squat? You know, do you just force an eviction? And if I had kids, well, shit, that's a no-brainer. You probably force an eviction, because what else are you going to do? You're going to put kids in the street? But in my case, I got no kids. I have no wife or girlfriend, and sure as shit, I don't want one right now. So for me, the question is, what do I take with me? Like, I don't have much. I mean, I barely fill out the apartment I'm living in right now, and it is not large. That is a polite way of saying it. This apartment in Little Saigon is very small, and there's space. That's how much shit I have. So the question I have is, can I get to a point in the next 2 to 3 weeks where everything I have, everything I care to hold on to, will fit into a duffel bag? I don't want to end up there. I don't know who rationally wants to sink. Okay, nobody wants to drown or sink. And I'm not really talking about drowning. If you end up homeless, that sucks. But it's not the end of the world. The end of the world is when you die. So in the great cascade of possibilities, homelessness, as shitty as it is, isn't nearly as shitty as dying of cancer. It's not nearly as shitty, probably, as dying in some prison cell someplace. There are worse realities. I can imagine them. Being homeless in a third world country would be a worse reality. When I was stationed in Korea 20 years ago in the army, I saw this poor dude in the streets. He was sliding on his chest. He had no legs, basically using little mitten gloves to pull himself along on wheels on this little cart. And a couple of the officers with me, they chuckled, and I couldn't laugh. I didn't know why they laughed, but it was like, shit, you know, that's fucking hard. So, yeah, being homeless sucks. Dropping off the social radar sucks. But there are worse levels of hell. If you haven't experienced them, you can go to the library and you can read about them. Read about the Siege of Leningrad. Read about Leningrad between 1941 and 1943. And ask yourself, what would it have been like to be in Leningrad during 1942? That was a tough fucking year to be in Leningrad. There was cannibalism in Leningrad in 1942. People were so hungry, they were eating each other. So yeah, I'm having this conversation about being homeless, and it's kind of depressing, because shit, man, you would think, software engineer in Seattle, I should have no problem getting a good job. But guess what? Reality hits us all, and I don't want to go off into the culture, the gestalt, the zeitgeist, the general perspective of being a programmer in Seattle. That's a topic I have beaten to death. But I think everybody needs to get over the following: that homelessness only happens to people who are weak or stupid or, for whatever reason, are terrible people and they deserve it. You know what? There's a percentage of homeless people that are crazy drug addicts and criminals. And yeah, they ended up there because that was the ground state of their existence. That was where it was always going to go. But I'm sorry, when I walk around, especially when I see families living out of tents off of Rainier Avenue, my first thought when I see these families basically trying to collect water, trying to find a warm place to sleep, is not, well, shit, these scumbags, they deserve it. No, my first thought is, holy fuck. You know, there but for the grace of God. The other thing is this. I have family, and I have one or two family members that still give a shit about me. I think that things are going to get so tough that giving a shit will become a luxury for the rich. But I have a couple family members who will still put me up for a night or two, maybe even longer. I've just reached the point where I can't do that. I mean, I think as weird as this sounds, I'd almost rather be homeless than living with a family member at this point. And then there's this weird thought, and it's kind of weird and probably fucked up, but maybe there's something essentially liberating about letting go of all your bullshit, letting go of all your stuff, all your crap, all the things society says you need. Of course, if you want to find a job, especially in technology in Seattle, but pretty much any job now, and that includes gig jobs, like you go online and say, well, you can do a gig job, you know, assuming there's one you can do where you're not driving a car on a lease, right? You need to have a smartphone. And it's not just a phone, not just a flip phone. You have to have a smartphone. Well, I don't currently have a smartphone, and my flip phone is 2 months, you know, out of service. So if you don't have a phone, you have already removed yourself pretty much from the socioeconomic radar. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, it sucks because it means I can't talk to asshole recruiters who are going to lie to me about jobs that don't exist. That's really depressing. But on the other hand, I don't get a lot of shitty calls. Here's another thing about being homeless. There's nothing to collect. Like, people are constantly being harassed by bill collectors. And they'll say things like, well, you'll lose your home or you'll lose your car. Well, you know, already lost my car. It was repossessed a year ago and don't have a home. And probably within a few weeks, what little shit I have is going to be, like I said, trimmed down to what fits into a fucking duffel bag. So there is a kind of liberating power to that, just saying to yourself, how much do I need to survive? And then the question is, well, how will you survive, Dan? Will you simply beg? Well, here's the thing. I think most of the quote-unquote jobs in this quote-unquote economy, especially when it comes to the middle class, they're make-work jobs, okay? You go into a place like Microsoft or Amazon or Google or the fucking Alaska Airlines I was at last, and you'll see 50 people in a room. My guess is the same work could be done with 10 or 15. But there's a lot of people, and I think this has more to do with politics and culture and maybe even cultural Marxism than anything else, but there are a lot of people in the business world today who have no real purpose being there, especially in software engineering. They're simply taking up space, but they play the game. This is my great defect. And it wasn't a defect when I first got into the field. Back in 2004, it was kind of a positive. My great defect is I'm a really good computer programmer, and I couldn't give a shit about any of the other bullshit. I couldn't give a fuck what your sexuality is. I don't give a fuck what your race is. I don't care to go through a touchy-feely session. And frankly speaking, I'd rather get down and get shit done than wasting time in meetings. So that was a positive, you know, 14 years ago. It's not a positive today. In fact, even a person who I know, he said this to me when I moved back here. He said, Dan, if you want to get a good job in Seattle, you have to be the kind of person, and he was talking about software engineering, you have to be the kind of person people want to have a beer with. And it's like, I thought about it. I pondered that, and it more or less reinforced what I knew. And what I knew when I left here the last time, back in 2014, a lot of jobs now, especially what's left of these middle-class jobs, they're bullshit. I don't know why they exist. It's kind of like Amazon. Amazon doesn't make a fucking profit. It just survives on expanding revenue. Yet, it's the most valuable company in America today, right? It doesn't make a fucking profit. If you wanted an emblem, a symbol of our economy, fucking Amazon. You know, do I think logistics is an interesting problem? Yes. Do I think the transfer and storage of goods and services is a problem that can be solved efficiently? Certainly. Do I think Jeff Bezos and Amazon as a company initially came up with some interesting solutions to commerce? Maybe. But do I think that company has ever been thoroughly tested by anything like restrictive economics, where they had to pay the same amount for capital, for money, for investment resources that, you know, in terms of interest rates, that ordinary people had to pay? Like, let's say you're an ordinary schlub and you're starting a business. My guess is unless you're in some sort of a minority government program, you're going to be paying 7, 8, 10% for a business loan. And that's with collateral, okay? That's with actually saying, oh, I'll sign over my fucking house to you. But during the heydays of quantitative easing, companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Google, General Electric, which is now a zombie, oh yeah, GE, I think they have $160 billion of debt with a B. Yeah, these companies survived on the largesse of the Federal Reserve printing money. They survived on the sloshiness of liquidity that was out there for the ultra wealthy. But don't for a minute think that ordinary people starting businesses were seeing any of that. Sure, sure, sure. Ordinary schlubs were seeing cars that had appreciated, you know, I don't know, 50 to 100% in value in the space of a couple years under Obama. Sure, they were getting 0% loans on shitty cars. That's a true statement. During this last period of quote unquote expansion, there were a lot of shitty things that were being, you know, I don't know how to put this. There were a lot of shitty contracts that allowed poor people to purchase vehicles that were too expensive at near 0% interest. That's true. But if the same poor people simply want to start a fucking business, all they want, instead of buying a fucking Camry for 23 grand of loans at 0%, they want to take 23 grand and start a business. Well, it wouldn't be 0%. It probably wouldn't be 5%. Like I said, even at the peak of QE, it would have been closer to 7 or 8% for that business loan. Amazon? No, they would more or less be given money to buy their own stock, just like fucking Microsoft, just like all these fucking companies, to play whatever chicanery they needed to. And even if Amazon, for example, wasn't doing all the chicanery, they lived off the chicanery. Amazon as a company lives and dies off of this bullshit, this financialization. You suck it away, and I hate to break it to everybody out there, more people will go to the bargain store, more people will go to the thrift shop, and fewer people will buy Amazon shit. That's just a simple fact. One which will become glaringly obvious in the months to come if we are looking at the end of this quote-unquote expansion. So I do get frustrated with people who live in a delusional world. They want to believe with their heart, deep down inside, that some miracle is going to come along and save them because, shit, they're the middle class, right? They're the good people. They're supposed to be the foundation. Nobody gives a fuck about you. The people at the top hate your fucking guts. They will do everything to destroy your world. I don't care if you're right or left, Democrat or Republican, they don't give a fuck about you. And as far as your peers go, or people underneath you in this economic strata, they're just trying to survive. So in a sense, they're too fucking busy to give a shit about you. And yeah, for people like me, and I'm not special, and I really don't need any special concern or pity, you know, whatever boat I'm in, sinking boat, it's one of my own construction. Yeah, for people like me, if we disappear, if we simply drop off the radar, it doesn't matter. This is the thing I don't think people get, but they will. They'll get it soon enough. If you're someone from the ordinary classes, from the classes of the peons and the plebes and the serfs, you are expendable. You are throwaway. You are garbage as far as the system is concerned. You know, it's something that it boggles. It's like Brexit. Back in 2016 when Brexit passed, and I know I'm switching topics a bit here, talking about the UK, but when the people of the United Kingdom, or at least England, voted to leave the EU, it was like, holy shit, they're going to leave the EU. I was deeply skeptical. I thought, yeah, I don't know. This, if anything, this seems like the ruling class is letting off steam, you know, from the boiling pot. But I didn't think it would happen. Well, I hate to break it to you guys, but I think I'll turn out right on this one. You know, in March, supposedly, the UK is going to leave the EU. Not going to happen. April, it won't happen. May, it won't happen. It just isn't going to happen. They, or whatever you want to call them, the ruling class doesn't give a fuck if you all vote to end war. Like to say, we all want peace. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to listen to anything you say. Democracy is a failure for lots of reasons, but not the least of which is that in systems like ours, you can vote for something and you still, even if you vote for it, even if it's supported by the majority of people, you will still get fucked. To this day, okay, this is 2019. I need to emphasize this fucking point because there's a lot of stupid fucking people out there. This is 2019. To this day, the marijuana industry in Washington State cannot use the banking system. People of Washington State voted to legalize weed. Sure, they piled on a lot of stupid taxes and regulations, but they voted to do it. And to this fucking day, the marijuana industry cannot use the banking system. If you want to understand the truth of things, you need to meditate on that. So no, I don't think it's that shocking to ask yourself, how much could you get rid of? Especially if you're single, you don't have kids. How much could you get rid of to survive? At this point, you know, if I want to survive, if I want to keep going, if I want to make it another day, once February rolls around, I'm going to have to get rid of most of what I have left. And as stated, what I have left, or at least the stuff I moved in with, fit into a Army aviation bag and an Army duffel bag that I had left over from 20 years ago. That was pretty much most of it. Okay, so it's not like I'm talking about scaling down from being, you know, wealthy or something. I'm talking about scaling from being poor to being more poor. And if I sound disgruntled, it's the following reason. I'm tired of talking to people that are negotiating with reality, like pretending that there's going to be some magical thing that happens to save them. For years, I have been telling people who have leverage, buy a farm. I wanted to buy a farm before my divorce. And in 2016, for reasons I don't want to go into, I was close to looking for farmland to buy my own farm. It didn't happen. Don't want to talk about 2016 or 2017. Not real good years for me. But the thing is, I've been telling people, get a farm. Learn how to grow some food. Even if you're not good at it, learn how to fucking grow some potatoes. People don't listen. They keep thinking, it's kind of like the Seattle super city thing. I can't tell you how many people in the last 20 years have told me, well, Dan, there are these super cities like Seattle or San Francisco or, excuse me, New York or, excuse me, Chicago that will simply be economically successful forever and they never have to worry about recessions again. Well, forever is a lot longer than 30 years. I need to point this out to all the attention deficit assholes out there staring at their phones. Forever lasts longer than 30 or 40 years. It's measured by a bit more than that. That's A. And B, just because you were standing at the free throw line during the basketball game and you made two shots in a row does not imply you're going to make the third shot. Okay? Past success does not guarantee future success. In fact, in many cases, because of hubris, it guarantees the opposite. So no, just because you live in Seattle and you think, well, Seattle's doing really great, you know, unless you live in White Center or Little Saigon or South Park or any of the number of other places I could rattle off in Seattle that aren't doing so fucking well. But let's assume you're living in one of the nice, juicy parts of Seattle that still seems to be doing okay. Just because you've been doing okay for 40 years does not imply you'll be doing okay next year or this year. Okay? These processes are kind of complicated. Anywho. I guess this is a long-winded way of saying something that I don't think should be that earth-shattering, and it's depressing that it is. A, people like me become homeless, and it's not because they're shitty human beings, but they're, in my case, imperfect human beings, and imperfection at this point in human history can be hazardous to your economic health. So that's A, imperfect people become homeless. And B, you need to be willing, if you want to survive in this world, you need to be willing to accept levels of existence that might be worse than what you're experiencing today. It's awesome to have shelter. You know, when I was making money a few months ago, I paid ahead on rent. Thank fucking God. Okay, maybe I ran out of money for food, but you know, you can always get the rotten food at the food bank, right? And I mean rotten because the last couple times I've been there, they handed out rotten food. But finding a warm place to sleep at night is real fucking hard. So thank God I paid ahead on rent. Sure, February is going to be cold and so will March, but April rolls around, it starts getting warmer. That's the thing. Is that I can accept the fact that B, as I said, number B or point B, people like us become homeless, not because they're shitty, dirty people, not because they're scumbags, not because they deserve it or don't deserve it, but maybe just because they made the wrong decisions at the wrong time. And yes, in the game of life, that sucks. And outcomes can be terrible. But I'm not going to fucking spend all day trying to rationalize to stupid fucking people how it is Daniel John Sullivan could become homeless. Okay? A, I'm not there yet. And B, if I end up there in a month, it isn't the end of the world. There are lots of homeless people in Seattle. It's actually becoming quite a large group of people. And you know what? I am intrigued. It's almost as if it's a mystery that needs to be resolved. There's a school of thought that says homeless people deserve it. Okay, maybe. And there's another school of thought that says maybe for the most part, the homeless population represents a subsection of America. Good, bad, criminal, non-criminal. And perhaps at least half the homeless people are there primarily for economic reasons. That would be my contention. That 50% of the homeless in this country are there primarily because, yes, the economy isn't so fucking rosy. And that people do drop off the radar. And once they're off the radar, especially when it comes to that thing called the smartphone, or sometimes I call it the dog collar, when you can't even afford to pay for your dog collar, well, you're not going to get any work on the sled, you know? So have a great rest of your Tuesday. And adios.